as you said at the start, my background's in intensive care medicine and anaesthesia. And I'm going to talk about conscientious objection as how it may appear within my practice. Though I've got an interest in ethics and the law, I am neither an ethicist or a philosopher. And instead, this is possibly going to be more a boots on the ground talk about what happens at 3 o'clock in the morning on a rainy night in Paisley. So,
I've been there.
Yeah. So, from that point of view, I've got my background in anaesthesia and intensive care medicine. I've got an interest in ethics, and then to confound everything, I've got 20 years of Roman Catholic upbringing that I've got to reconcile into all these things. I thought I'd start by asking my own practice, can I define what a matter of conscience is? Because a lot of my colleagues will talk about conscientious objection. I've talked about conscientious objection before. But can I actually define it? Is it where the source of the situation carries some sort of religious or philosophical dimension that takes us out with our normal clinical practice or things that we can quote papers about, perhaps? Is it where the outcome leaves me with a degree of anguish and uncertainty which goes beyond a professional level and confronts me on perhaps a more metaphysical one? Or is it, as one of my colleagues says, it's because something just feels like a matter of conscience? And that, perhaps, for a room like that, isn't helpful, but it's also what we as clinicians sometimes actually experience. Things are a matter of conscience because we can't quote a paper about it, and they ultimately feel that way. And there's a difference or a conflict between what my wishes or beliefs are and what the patient or their proxy's beliefs are as well. And it's maybe this notion of some sort of conflict. It's where things move into an idea of people wanting to discuss them in terms of conscience or matters of conscience. So we've got a representative from the BMA here. I had a quick look and taken off the website. BMA's got a great ethical toolkit. I'm bigging up your website there. But with a summary of things. So they talked about doctors should have a right to conscientiously object to participation in abortion, fertility treatment, and the withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment where there is another doctor willing to take over the patient's care. Doctors should be able to request that arrangements are made to accommodate their conscientious objections to participating in other medical procedures, provided that patients are not disadvantaged. Doctors should not claim conscientious objection to treating a particular patient or patient group. I think that's really important, but we'll touch on a particular patient group in my anaesthesia and intensive care practice that actually can raise some issues. Doctors should not share their private moral views with patients unless explicitly invited to do so. And doctors should ensure that any manifestation of the religious or cultural belief do not impact negatively on their therapeutic relationship. Okay, so that all seems sort of fairly common sense about this. So where do matters arise then in my own practice? Well, I can recognise that there's going to be a dynamic that will exist between my own belief structures and the belief structures also of my patients. Okay? And that will in some ways determine or interact with what I think my beliefs will allow me to do, but also what the belief structures of my patients will allow me to do with them. What do I mean by that? Well, in anaesthesia, we think in terms of, when we talk of conscientious objection, terminations, as comes up often. Also in the notion of DNA CPR and advanced directives, and I'll come back to talking that a wee bit. A big issue for us, actually, in anaesthesia is patients who are Jehovah's Witnesses. And that has got a lot of implications because, amongst all the other things that have been said, that the BMA have said that we can opt into conscientious objection with, providing anaesthesia electively for Jehovah's Witnesses is something that we are allowed to opt out from on grounds of conscientious objection. And the idea behind that is that a lot of anaesthetists feel that they would not want to be privy or part of someone's otherwise avoidable death when it comes to the use of blood products and blood transfusion products. Something that I didn't realise recently, but it has started to raise its idea in anaesthesia literature, is the notion of veganism. And should somebody's lifestyle choice, when they adopt a vegan lifestyle, influence how I provide anaesthesia, how I potentially provide safe anaesthesia, what with the basic anaesthetic drug propofol being derived from egg and milk derivatives, or how a lot of our resuscitative fluids might contain gelatins as well. And then in anaesthesia, we've got to think in terms of non-essential surgery, because I have had and heard some of my colleagues talk in terms of not wanting to embark on a particular operative course on a matter of conscience because of certain things that have arisen in the pre-op interview for this person's anaesthesia. When I say non-essential surgery, what do I mean by that? Could I mean cosmetic surgery? Could I mean orthopaedic surgery, where it's to repair a hip? Could I actually mean some forms of, or in some cases, some forms of cancer types surgeries, where anaesthetists will refuse to anaesthetise somebody based on the relative risk of that patient, based on their perception of benefit and harm in that particular instance, drawing on quite often previous clinical cases that they've seen, or perhaps on the basis of resource as well. Now, I have said no to anaesthetising patients for esophagectomies. An esophagectomy for cancer surgery carries a 5 to 10% mortality risk if everything goes well with it, and carries a 40% mortality, morbidity risk associated with it. So this is very high-risk surgery. And when we've got these patients and we've put them on exercise bikes to try and stratify their risk for this surgery, we've seen that the outcomes are very high in mortality. Some patients will accept that when you sit down and chat at length to say that, look, I really don't think that you're either going to survive this surgery or get out of get out of hospital after this surgery. Whereas some feel that because it's cancer, they've got to fight the cancer and therefore should be allowed, regardless of the outcome, to have their surgery. But that has got implications for me as the person who could potentially kill them at the end of their syringe or during theatre, and also lots of implications for the hospital and resources as a whole when this person will end up in an intensive care unit, not getting out of hospital in the end. And sometimes we think that this is a clinical decision, but sometimes this also feels as if it could be couched in terms of a matter of conscience. I can't go ahead with this because I feel on an ethical level that I am doing more harm, that I am compromising care to other patients as well. I'd mentioned DNA CPR as well, because that can come up particularly with a patient without capacity who comes to theatre, particularly for some of our more demented patients who've come for trauma hip surgery. Now, the hip surgery itself is viewed as a palliative procedure. We are doing the hip surgery to relieve pain. But if that patient has a DNA CPR in place, perhaps something that they have discussed beforehand, should we suspend that DNA CPR order for the duration of their perioperative period, because a lot of the anaesthetic drugs that we give could actually cause cardiac arrest. And if we do a small part of CPR to either allow resuscitative drugs to get round their system, is that an acceptable breach of their DNA CPR order? And was their DNA CPR order written with that in mind at the time? Or is this a situation that is separate to the spirit in which that DNA CPR order was originally written? When I move into intensive care medicine, okay, again, we've got to think in terms of end-of-life care. We've got a pediatric anaesthetist here. Pediatric intensive care outcomes are much better than adult intensive care outcomes. The mortality in a pediatric intensive care, yes, better and smilier. The outcome in a pediatric intensive care overall is probably about a 2-3% mortality. Adult ICU is probably sitting with all comers of about 25% mortality. So 1 in 4 of the patients that I admit to my unit will die. And of those 1 in 4 that die, about 70% of them, intensive care physicians will have a role in that death, either by limiting treatment at a ceiling level or through withdrawing treatment and changing to a completely palliative bent as well. And again, these things of how we do that has got to be reconciled with both what the family want, what we think is in the best interest of the patient, and can in some ways be governed by our own belief systems as well. We sometimes have to deal in terms of maternal critical care as well, dealing with either the pregnant woman who has temporarily lost capacity, or in the cases of extreme and serious head injuries, the pregnant woman who may technically even be legally dead, but there is an ongoing fetal life at that point in time, and how we can again reconcile our own beliefs, the beliefs of the family, what may or may not have been the beliefs of the pregnant woman too. From an organ donation point, that is something where quite often other people's or families' conscientious beliefs can influence our own care. Most intensive care physicians have treated people or been unable to treat people who have been waiting for heart transplants, waiting for lung transplants. So we do get to see the burden of patients who do not get organs. And sometimes it can be difficult for us when families, even if somebody does have an organ donation card or is otherwise on the register, say as a matter of their conscience, they wouldn't want the organ donation to go ahead. I've mentioned Jehovah's Witnesses before under the idea of anaesthesia. Jehovah's Witnesses can actually potentially be, and I'm going to use the word burden, but more in a sort of clinical or resource sense here, in intensive care medicine as well. When Jehovah's Witnesses make their choice or choice of conscience to not receive blood transfusions, I've seen several occasions of people having prolonged intensive care admissions within our ICUs where their hemoglobin has sat at 4, and as a result of that, we've been unable to wean them off blood pressure supporting medicines and unable to wean them off the ventilation. I've seen one extreme case a few years ago where a Jehovah's Witness was in intensive care for 8 weeks, and during that time there were 10 patients transferred to other hospitals because there was no facility to care for them within the intensive care unit that the Jehovah's Witness was in, because in Scotland has lots of small intensive care units with 5 or 6 beds. And as soon as one of those beds becomes blocked, that has a huge resource implication. But we have to, again, respect people's both right to autonomy and their own conscientious objection beliefs and how that can interact with how we practice medicine as well. Sometimes, and carrying on from the last talk as well, there is this idea of futile interventions. Now, in my own practice, it has quite often not been the family saying that we want you to stop, or this is not in somebody's best interest. And it might be a reflection of the more acute side of intensive care that I've been involved in. But quite often we see the family members talking about wanting more intervention done than we actually feel comfortable doing. And from that point of view, we have to sometimes have a discussion and think, when we are talking about a treatment being futile, what do we actually mean by something being futile? So the concept of futility goes back to Hippocrates, even talked about not treating those who are overmastered by their disease. People have tried to define futility in different ways. Schneiderman tried to take a sort of clinical approach to saying that a treatment would be futile if it hadn't worked in the last 100 people. But you can't even define futility in that terms, because when we say is something futile, do we mean it's something that doesn't restore the person back to life? Is it something that doesn't restore the person back to interaction? Is it something that will have them alive but they'll be dead in 5 years? Or have them alive but they'll be dead in a year? Or is a treatment futile if it just doesn't bring any comfort to that person? And does prolonged ventilation or inotropic support, when we know that the person is ultimately going to succumb at the end, but continue that on for longer because that person, in the eyes of their family, is a fighter, is that something that is bringing them and their family some benefit? Or, in practical terms, is that us causing harm and suffering? And are we using up a finite resource, again, in our small intensive cares? The other difficulty we sometimes encounter with both Jehovah's Witnesses and other people who have a reason or a conscientious belief not to engage in an individual treatment is when their refusal of that part of the treatment renders our plan as a whole unsafe. Take, for example, emergency aortic aneurysm surgery in a Jehovah's Witness patient who has refused blood transfusion. I know, having done lots of... if somebody's aortic aneurysm ruptures, to put things in perspective, you have a 50% chance of dying before you get to the hospital, and once you get into theatre, you have another 50% chance of dying. The average transfusion requirements during these procedures will be in the order of at least an entire circulating volume, if not twice or three times that. If somebody has refused a blood transfusion but wants otherwise every chance to live, should I take that person to theatre at that point in time? They have done that in a matter of conscience, and then they want me to be part of that conscience decision, whereas I actually would genuinely believe in those circumstances I know what the outcome will be and that I'm going to be causing harm and undue suffering at that point in time. So these things I find very difficult sometimes to reconcile while paying attention to people's autonomy, but still trying to function in what I believe is my roles and duties as a doctor. I've sort of touched on this, the resources themselves do become a source in intensive care of moral anguish when we feel that we are continuing to do things without any overall benefit to it, and when we are also impinging, we think, potentially on the rights of other people who may want to access our service. With end-of-life care, it becomes difficult as well as how we can sort of strike a balance in our own practice between the idea of acts and omissions. Now, I've got colleagues and friends who work in Israel. And in Israel, you can't withdraw treatment, you can't omit treatment as well, and people can end up on ventilators ad infinitum. To get round that, some hospitals in Israel have ventilators that have timers on them, and the ventilators will turn themselves off at a given time, and therefore it's not the doctors that have withdrawn treatment at that point in time, and you have to make an active decision to get on. But these are part of some of the almost fudges that people use to try and get round this idea. I feel comfortable in my own mind and practice when it comes to end-of-life care of not prolonging suffering at all, but still acting in a relatively passive way. And maybe when it comes to end-of-life care, the idea should be for clinicians to try and square the circle and look for what their patients and their families are looking to get out of this bad situation, and try and reconcile that with their own belief processes. There's been a recent article in the British Medical Journal of Ethics looking at advanced directives in Holland for active euthanasia. I don't know if anyone has also come across that. And while a lot of my practice in end-of-life care I've reconciled myself to in the UK, I myself found that article very difficult to read. It had the idea of providing euthanasia for somebody whose self now was very different to their self then when they'd made the advanced directive in the first place. For those of you who have not read it, it does get pretty awful towards the end and degenerates into the family holding the person down while they get given their cocktail, because that's what they think they would have wanted when they had capacity. And I'm not sure, again, if that's something I could find myself being party to. But that then gives the dimension of where my own beliefs interact with that person's autonomy. I am a professional, and we talked earlier on about what makes me a professional. Is it working to a technical standard? Well, absolutely. Is it working to a standard of behaviour? Yes, it is as well. But as a professional, am I employed from the neck down, or am I supposed to actually bring in my own knowledge, some of my beliefs into my practice as well? Is that what makes me different from someone that follows a flowchart approach to medicine? And that then makes me think, do all matters of conscience therefore carry the same weight? And things, this again gets back to our earlier paper. This idea of, can we reach a sort of case consistency and reflective equilibrium? Well, I think actually the onus is on me, if I am going to play some sort of conscientious objection card, that I should be pretty sure of what I am objecting to and be able to justify that and take different case or find cases and divide them into things that are the same and things that are differently and act differently accordingly. I know that my patients have a right to life, a right to be free of torture, a right to liberty, a right to self-determination, a right to their own religious consciousness, and a right to be treated equal. But in some ways, I think I also have those rights. And I didn't believe that when I went into medicine, I should therefore sort of surrender to an amoral servitude associated with that. I don't know if I should have to forfeit my own rights in becoming a doctor. Particularly because when I went into medicine as well, there were lots of things I didn't know would be part of my practice. I had a Catholic upbringing. I knew that abortion was an issue. I didn't give much thought about fertility matters when I was 17, when I was 22, even coming out as a junior doctor. I didn't really know about the idea of nutrition, whether it was a treatment, whether it was something that was a basic right. And as ethics evolve, I'm not sure if it's fair to ask some doctors to give up their profession based on that. So at the end, I wanted to ask, is conscientious objection compatible with professionalism? Should those with a moral stance on an issue not be allowed to be part of that specialty or even in medicine? Well, that does seem like a huge loss. Medicine is diverse enough that people can contribute to a specialty and still express a moral stance on an issue, provided that neither party's rights or opportunities were infringed. And with planning, though it sometimes does take this blanket approach to things like abortion, maybe most instances can be accommodated. Pre-existing practitioners, maybe we have to think about whether or not they can be exempt or guided through evolving ethical matters that they didn't consider at the start. And on a final thought, I asked myself, does conscientious objection fail a test of universalisation? So this idea is, as one of my colleagues said, are those folk that refuse to do abortion only afforded that luxury because I go off and do the dirty work for them? What then would be the result if everyone refused to perform a procedure? But, as one of my other colleagues pointed out, if everyone thought that a course of action was wrong then, would there still be a place for it in clinical practice as a whole? And then I wondered, did that mean that Adam Smith actually thought that his hand was moral rather than just something that was involved in money and trade? So it's a bit wandered, but these are the issues that are sort of confronted by me in the middle of the night.